Hi, South by Southwesters. This is Peter Broderick from Paradigm Consulting, and I'm glad to be on the line with Scott Kirzner, editor of the blog Cinematheque, which if you're not a subscriber or a regular reader of, you're missing out, and author of the new book, Inventing the Movies, which we've been reading about in many publications around the country. So Scott, tell us about the sort of inspiration that led you to do the book in the first place, and sort of what the kind of central theme of the book is.
Well, you know, I think the inspiration for it was really, I've always been interested in new technologies and how they get introduced into the world, and often, you know, how people resist them and fight them kicking and screaming. And the more that I talked to people in the movie industry and started to write about Hollywood and independent filmmaking, it seemed like the perfect case study of how you've got these groups of people who are advocates for new technologies and developing them and promoting them, and you've got this other group of people that just don't want to change the way they do things. And so the book really wound up being a much bigger project than I thought. You know, it goes from the days of Thomas Edison in the 1890s to you know, the current era of YouTube and the iPod and peer-to-peer file sharing. And, you know, the theme that kind of underlies everything is that whenever someone's introducing a new idea, whether it's a new business model or a new technology or, you know, a new creative idea, that there's a large number, you know, I would say the majority of people that kind of want to preserve the status quo, and they tend to battle that new idea.
Well, you show so many examples of that over the years and in so many different areas that it's a pretty pervasive pattern. When did you start working on the book, and how recently did you finish it?
Well, I mean, I'm kind of a newcomer to the world of film and independent film. I really started working on it, I think, at Sundance in 2005, and really just finished it, you know, this spring or early summer of 2008. And it was just a really fun process, both to look at the establishment and visit the Hollywood studios and talk to people who run those studios or people who produce movies for those studios, but then also to talk to people, you know, like Jonathan Coet, who made Tarnation, a great movie that played at Sundance. You know, he says the budget was $250 and it was made on his iMac. You know, the guys who were involved in Napoleon Dynamite. And, you know, one of the things that's so interesting about the independent filmmakers at Sundance and at South by Southwest is that, you know, they're often at the vanguard. You know, they're the first people to see the potential of a new technology and start experimenting with it.
Well, when you think about sort of hierarchical power structures, the people on top think they have something to lose if things change, and the people at the bottom or, you know, outside the gate.
it's really true, right? They don't have anything to lose. They don't have anything to defend. They just want to make, you know, make art and tell their stories, really.
Right. And I think, you know, from my standpoint, working with lots of independent filmmakers over the years, the sequence, and this is definitely demonstrated in your book, because your book talks about many things. It talks about big Hollywood, from the biggest, most legendary Hollywood characters and studios, you know, to the newest indies. But for the independent filmmakers, the changes that I've seen, and you talk a lot about this recent period, but they started out and they needed other people's resources to make a film. This was before digital cameras and software on computers that would allow them to edit and do special effects. And then when digital technologies came in, for the first time, they could own the means of production and the means of post-production. So nobody could stop them from making a movie. But still, they had to get the permission and resources of third parties to distribute the film. And as you show at the end of the book, with the coming of digital distribution, now filmmakers have figured out ways to do distribution, you know, without conventional distribution. So nobody can stop them from making a movie, and nobody can stop them from bringing a movie into the world.
Yeah, you know, the Francis Ford Coppola quote when I talked to him for the book was, he said, cinema's escaping being controlled by the financier, and that's a wonderful thing. You don't have to go hat in hand to some film distributor and say, please, will you let me make a movie? You know, so I think you're right. You know, we saw the democratization of production really over the last 10, 15, 20 years. And right now you're seeing the democratization of distribution in a really powerful way, whether filmmakers want to sell DVDs or whether they want to sell downloads.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting, each of the different chapters, you know, you give examples of this conflict between people interested in innovation, and you call them preservationists. I find that a very gentle term for people who are fighting tooth and nail against innovation.
What would you call them, like meatheads?
Foot draggers? Well, the people looking backwards who can tell you how things have always been done.
Yeah.
They're
definitely traditionalists. They're conservatives. I mean, preservationist was the term that I kind of landed on just because, you know, what I see them doing most often is trying to preserve the status quo, you know, whether that's a business model that they're really comfortable with, like, you know, Hollywood studios still prefer to sell DVDs and Blu-ray DVDs than to sell you a movie on iTunes, you know, or it's preserving, you know, cutting movies on film or shooting movies on film or some other kind of tool or, you know, existing process that they don't want to have go away.
Well, in each different chapter, you have another set of folks that think they have something to lose. So when you talk about digital editing, there's the, you know, old guard editors who just edit on film their whole lives, and then all of a sudden there's this nonlinear scary thing that happens. And
you know, one of the most incredible quotes to me was, you know, Stephen Cohen was one of the first editors in Hollywood to really start using the Avid system and kind of to help Avid break into Hollywood. And he even told me, you know, he said, the thing that's unfortunate now that you have Avid and you have Final Cut Pro is that everyone can get lots of experience editing when they're in their teens and their 20s, and suddenly you have people competing with us for jobs who are much younger than ever before. You know, in the old world, you really had to apprentice with an existing editor, you know, and just to try to get time on the machine and see how they used it. And now, you know, you can spend your teens and your college years apprenticing, you know, over your laptop, and suddenly you become a pretty good editor.
And there are also all the other reasons that the online editors resisted, the idea that somebody could look over their shoulder more easily, which you talk about, that, you know, in the old movieola days, you know, it was sort of a tiny screen that the editor could kind of monopolize.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The idea that directors can say, no, let's try it 100 different ways, and
right,
you have to put up with that.
And it's funny because a lot of old school cinematographers said the same thing about the video tap and having video monitors on the set. Because before, it was really just the cinematographer that looked through,
right,
you know, through the viewfinder and said, yeah, that was a great take. And everyone sort of took their word for it, or at least until dailies, you know, the dailies showed up. And now you have this monitor where it's like the producer's girlfriend is sitting there saying, no, I think, you know, her dress is too wrinkly in that take. You know, you need to do it again. And the cinematographers don't like that.
Well, I can remember the conflict, you know, with the editors when nonlinear editing came in first available. People, the established editors would say, well, this will never fly. We're going to just keep editing movies on film. And I think Spielberg's one of the last holdouts. Is he still editing on film, do you know?
Yeah. I mean, he's, as far as I know, there's not been a Spielberg-directed movie that's been edited digitally. You know, the story that I heard through the grapevine was that George Lucas, you know, one of his closest friends, was trying to convince him to shoot the latest Indiana Jones movie digitally, and it didn't work. You know, so he's still shooting on film, and he still works with his editor, Michael Kahn, who edits on film. Although Kahn also does know how to use the new technology, and he edits movies on, you know, on Avid as well.
Right. Well, I remember in the late 90s when I was at Canon 98 when the Celebration and the Idiots were there, and that was the beginning of Dogma 95 and the idea that you could shoot a movie on a camera that was designed to take pictures of babies' first steps and show them on the living room television. And so you had this tremendous resistance, not just from Kodak, but from, you know, experienced cinematographers, about shooting digitally and degrading the image and, you know, the end of cinema as we know it. And the other great holdouts at that time period were film professors.
Mm-hmm.
Because
and why do you think they, why were they holding out?
Well, I mean, I think it just comes down to, you know, they have a certain expertise, just like the cinematographers. And they were afraid that if things, movies were being made a different way, that was undercutting their expertise. And there could be, you know, new experts coming along who understood things that, that they didn't
mm-hmm.
know.
Yeah. It's funny. I mean, some of the feedback that I've gotten from the book actually mentions Dogma 95, and the book doesn't really touch on that at all, just because it's a very, you know, fairly U.S.-centric book. I mean, I just wanted to focus the story on, you know, Hollywood and the movies in the United States. There are a couple passages that talk about, you know, how digital cinema has taken off more quickly outside of the United States. But, you know, Dogma 95 is, you know, is a great thing that, you know, if I had that one extra chapter, you know, or added those 5 or 10 extra pages, I would have touched on.
Well, you can put it on the additional materials that are available on your website for readers of your book.
Yeah, thanks for mentioning those.
So, tell me about the role of indies. I mean, it seems that, you know, the biggest and baddest independent of them all, George Lucas, was a force for change, you know, on so many fronts, special effects, you know, editing, you know, digital production. Do you think that he was the force in many ways that pushed things along?
I do think he helped push a lot of things along. You know, it's kind of a mixed bag because, you know, he's kind of seen almost as a real outsider and someone who always has kind of done his own thing. And so, you know, he isn't in Hollywood. He's not there kind of mixing it up day after day. And so I think maybe he hasn't been able to nudge people as hard or as quickly as he wanted to. You know, nonlinear editing took much longer than he wanted it to. Digital cinematography still hasn't, you know, hasn't taken over, and that's something he's been working on for about 10 years now. You know, so I do think there's some frustration there that, you know, even though he's willing to experiment with stuff and you know, put quite a lot of money behind it and use digital cameras, you know, and digital projectors on his Star Wars movies, you know, it hasn't quite, you know, it hasn't quite taken off as quickly as he'd want. But, you know, he was very, you know, by hooking up with, say, the folks at Texas Instruments or the folks at Sony Electronics who, you know, who introduced kind of some of the first 24 frame a second digital cameras, you know, he really helped those companies kind of break into the movie industry.
Well, I thought your research was great on that. You showed the sort of moments, the specific moments where George and his producer, you know, were having dinner with Sony, or they were at a screening, and they said what they wanted, and you know, one of the key engineers said, "We can do it."
Mm-hmm.
You know, that kind of moment in time, and then you talk about when George decided to show one of the Star Wars, you know, with digital projection in a couple different cinemas on the East Coast and West Coast.
Yeah,
and he just
yeah.
told Fox he was going to do it, and they had a kind of, you know, live with it. And I think it was those screenings where a lot of people in the industry for the first time saw, you know, digital projection in a real movie theater with a real audience
mm-hmm.
that were persuasive.
Yeah, and it was, you know, that those screenings were kind of, I think, 1999 with the release of The Phantom Menace. And, you know, it was interesting because you still had a lot of people in the industry saying that the projection wasn't good enough, and yet you had the ticket buyers who went to those screenings saying, wow, this looks great. You know, I can't imagine seeing it any other way. So, you know, there always is that dynamic where the professionals and the people who are, you know, the Hollywood golden eyes can see something that, maybe audiences don't care about that much. I mean, I was talking with some people last night about YouTube, and you know, one of the things, the criticisms that you first heard about YouTube when it came along was the video quality is terrible. No one's going to watch this. I mean, it's hard. You know, it's like someone smeared Vaseline on your computer screen, and you're watching video through that. And yet, you know, YouTube is the dominant site where people are watching video on the internet today. And you know, sometimes as much as we love high quality and beautiful, pristine images, that's not what the mainstream audience demands.
But I think that in a way, you know, the mainstream audience is smarter than we give them credit for, because for them, it's not about production values. It's about the thing itself.
Yeah.
And if the particularly, you know, if the thing itself is kind of rough and ready, then, you know, the YouTube look can be, you know, perfectly appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly
yeah.
didn't hurt the OK Go people, who I just looked at their video recently, and they've had almost 40 million views on YouTube.
Yeah, I mean, they're incredible. I actually talked to them for this next book that I just started working on because, you know, it's fascinating. They're a band that's on a record label, you know, on a pretty well-known record label, and yet this homemade video of them on the treadmills, which, you know, they didn't even think they were going to release. They just kind of shot it almost as a joke, you know, has gotten more views than any professionally produced music video with a budget
right.
that people have distributed on YouTube.
So sometimes production values are overrated, as are budgets.
yeah, which is good news for independent filmmakers.
Right.
I think.
So, okay, so looking, now that you've, you know, put all this together for us and helped us understand the sort of patterns and the secrets, when you look at this moment in time forward, where do you see the most exciting opportunities for independent filmmakers?
Well, you know, one is in the area that you really focus on, which is kind of the avenues of distribution, and it's, you know, it's really exciting to be able to sell DVDs on demand and not have to you know, burn 1,000 or 5,000 of your own DVDs and fulfill orders, and you know, so to sell through things like Amazon's CreateSpace subsidiary, to sell digital downloads. I mean, I think iTunes is slowly opening up to more independent filmmakers, although they've been really way too slow on that, in my opinion. So, you know, avenues of distribution are creating opportunities, and I also think that the ways that people are watching video and the kinds of video that they want to watch are creating new creative opportunities, and I think that that's been, you know, not really well understood. I mean, filmmakers want to keep making 90-minute long or, you know, 100-minute long feature films, and yet the audience behavior now on the internet is watching things that are 3 minutes long and 5 minutes long, and maybe if you're lucky, 10 minutes long. And you know, I look at stuff like Dr. Horrible's Sing Along Blog, the Joss Whedon series that came out this year, as really important experiments in saying, can you do creative stuff? Can you do fun, high quality storytelling in a, you know, 7 or 8 minute format? You know, and can you use the internet to distribute it? I just don't see enough people working to sort of figure out what the new forms and the new genres are going to be. But I'd be curious, you know, I'd be curious to hear your take on those two things, because, you know, I know that you think about them both a lot too.
Well, I mean, I think there's some interesting examples. Robert Greenwald made 4, you know, hour to 90-minute documentaries in a row, all of which were successful. And then after A Rock for Sale, he tells me, okay, Peter, I'm done with that. Now I'm going to make things that are, you know, 3 to 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you go to the Brave New Films website and look at the, you know, the latest John McCain video, I think it's had, I don't know, 7 or 8 million views.
Mm-hmm.
And it's 5 minutes long. And if it, you know, it had been feature length, I'm sure it would have been a fraction of that. So he has the capacity with his team to, you know, make something that's that short, put it on the web, go out virally, and get a kind of instant distribution and an instant response and an instant impact on the, you know, on the campaign. So I think that's just too exciting to go back to the old idea of spending a year, you know, making a full-length film. A couple of filmmakers I've talked to recently, one of which is David Zeiger. He's working on a new project, and originally he was conceiving of it as a feature-length documentary. But the footage that he's got is so urgent and timely that he's decided to make it first as a web series. Now, this isn't, you know, a soap opera like some of the other web series. This is
mm-hmm.
a, you know, serious documentary news series. And then down the road, as he's built an audience, he'll see where it goes. It might, you know, might turn into a feature-length documentary or not. So I think some filmmakers are thinking about the timing and the opportunities that the web creates and saying, you know, the material they have that is today everyone will want to see, you know, a year and a half from now, you know, may not, that same thing may not be true. So I think people are beginning to, you know, try different things, and I think that's exciting. In terms of distribution, you know, I did this new article called "Welcome to the New World of Distribution," which is on my website at peterbroderick.com,
and which everyone was talking about last week at the IFP Filmmaker Conference.
Well, that was fun. That you know, everybody seemed to have a reaction to it, but it really fits with what your book you know has you know revealed to us all, and that you know there are these sort of worlds that coexist, and you know you talk about a lot of things beyond distribution, you know, the actual making of movies, but you know, I think at any moment in time, you know, we could, whatever, the 30s, 40s, 50s, whenever you pick, you know, there's a set of folks that, you know, we could see as the old world who, you know, have experience, you know, have been in power, have succeeded, you know, in a certain framework. And then, you know, there's sort of this, usually a new generation that's come along, and then the, you know, the people that have been successful, you know, want to keep the new generation in their place. And so sometimes that new generation just sort of moves out of that old context and creates, you know, a new context, you know, goes to kind of a new world. And I think that, you know, when you look and see where innovation has come from with, you know, in a lot of these areas, it's the independence outside the studios that, you know, we're nimble, we're lean and mean, you know, had nothing to lose, as you say, that could introduce the innovation. Mm-hmm. So making films digitally, you know, okay, George Lucas, you know, did it, and then, you know, a couple other people have done it, but, you know, independent filmmakers really adopted it. You look in, about, you know, theatrical projection, stuff has been happening in festivals, you know, much more broadly, and it happened more quickly than it has happened in movie theaters. So I like the idea of a sort of another world. Usually, you know, it's the world where independents are in control as opposed to studios, where people are willing to try things and blaze new trails.
Mm-hmm. I guess I want to, before we run out of time, I want to ask you one last thing, which is, there were some interesting discussions at the filmmaker conference last week, and, you know, almost at every festival and film conference you go to, about windowing. And, you know, in particular, I was kind of going back and forth with Tom Bernard from Sony Pictures Classics about, you know, look, a lot of times when a movie plays at a festival, that's the most attention and publicity it's ever going to get in the life of the movie, whether it gets picked up for distribution or not sometimes. You know, and so why, you know, why not release the movie, you know, during the festival or the week after the festival, at least in some way that, like, interested people, you know, if you have friends who go to Sundance and they tell you, hey, I just saw this great movie, or friends who go to South by Southwest, and what are you supposed to do to act on that? Well, you're supposed to wait 6 or 9 months until someone picks it up for distribution and decides to release it and puts it in a theater, and then you wait another year if you want to watch it on your iPod or on DVD. I'm curious what you think about the idea that, you know, that windows aren't really serving us anymore in this kind of instant gratification world that we live in.
I think that's true. And I there's, you know, there's a couple examples that, you know, support what you're saying. A number of filmmakers that I've been working with have started selling DVDs at film festivals. And that's, you know, that would be a, you know, a mortal sin from the standpoint of conventional distributors, you know, as of, you know, probably a few months ago and maybe mm-hmm. today. But they're saying, you know, we've shown the film to an audience. There's a Q&A. People are, you know, have really responded to the movie. They have an opportunity to buy it then and, you know, have a copy of to keep or to, you know, give to somebody else as a gift who wasn't able to come to the screening. There's an immediacy to that that's you know, if filmmakers can take advantage of it. Then there are festivals, and Cinequest has been one of the leaders of this, that have made their films available online
mm-hmm.
at the same time that they've been in festivals. So I think, you know, I think festivals are exploring that, and as you know better than anybody, for traveling to all the festivals where you moderate panels and to other things, you know, there's a limited number of people who have the resources and are geographically, you know, whatever, available to get to specific festivals, and then there's the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that festivals are going to need to reinvent themselves in part so that they can have an audience that's broader than the people that can show up at one week in Salt Lake City or Park City or wherever it is.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that the festivals do create a unique opportunity. And then as theatrical has gotten harder and more dismal, the role of festivals in creating awareness, you know, has become more important. So I think filmmakers will explore some of that. And particularly if they're not going to make an overall distribution deal where Sony Classics, as in Tom Bernard, gets all the rights, but they're going to split up the rights and handle theatrical themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's a situation where there's versions so that, you know, in a documentary situation, maybe the festival version is something that goes out, and then later, you know, in terms of television, maybe there's another version of the film that's more updated and includes, you know, more material. So
mm-hmm.
I think people need to experiment, and every experiment, you know, there are lots of filmmakers that can learn from the results.
Well, I totally agree. You know, to plug South by Southwest a little bit, I mean, what's so interesting about that particular festival is that it happens alongside this interactive conference, you know, so that you have the sort of filmmakers and the techies and the internet people all in one place. And so I think that turns into a really interesting petri dish, that's quite different from most other film festivals.
I agree. And my old friend Janet Pearson is now running the festival, and I think that I'm sure that the festival is going to be doing great new things under Janet. So I'm excited about that. So let's go back to Inventing the Movies by Scott Kersner. Scott, it's available in many ways. So why don't you kind of run through how people can get it?
The most convenient way might be Amazon.com. It's also on Lulu.com, and there's a whole bunch of material that isn't in the book and some audio and video material at the book's website, which is ScottKersner.com, KIRSNER.com/inventing.
And can they order it right on the book's website?
Of course.
Oh.
Multiple distribution avenues, baby.
I hope that was the right answer.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for talking with me, Scott. And I just, for the people out there, I would say that, you know, Scott's done a great job pulling together information that in many cases I've never seen in print anywhere and finding the patterns out there. And I think that anybody that's, you know, interested in the idea of innovation in filmmaking, there's just so much for them to learn. So,
well, that's nice of you to say, and I have to credit you because, you know, we had some very early conversations while I was working on the book in 2005 where you kind of helped me understand the dynamics of the world and introduced me to some of the, you know, the independent filmmakers that were doing the most interesting stuff. So I'm grateful for that.
Well, you're more than welcome, and I'm impressed that you're already working on the next book. So you're not, you know, the kind of author. I mean, you're not the kind of author that, you know, every 5 years is going to come out with something new. You're just continually writing and creating more for us to read.
My attention span is too short.
Well, it's great talking with you, Scott.
Yeah, thanks for doing it.
Thanks for doing this.